Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Gerrymandering and the Equal Protection Clause Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On December 5th, 2016, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in McCrory v. Harris and Bethune-Hill v. Virginia State Board of Elections. In these related cases, the court considered redistricting plans introduced in North Carolina and Virginia after the 2010 census. Plaintiffs in McCrory argued that North Carolina used the Voting Rights Act's black voting age population requirements as a pretext to place more black voters in two particular U.S. House of Representatives districts in order to reduce black voters' influence in other districts. The district court determined that the redistricting plan was an unconstitutional racial gerrymander that violated the Equal Protection Clause because race was the predominant factor motivating the new plan. Plaintiffs in Bethune-Hill each resided in one of 12 newly proposed majority-minority districts for the Virginia legislature, created to satisfy Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which requires that any new districting plan must ensure that there be no retrogression and the ability of racial minorities to elect the candidate of their choice. They argued that the new districts constituted racial gerrymanders that violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. The district court held that the plaintiffs did not establish that race was the predominant factor in the creation of 11 of the 12 challenged districts. The district court also held that, although race was the predominant factor in the creation of one district, the General Assembly was pursuing a narrowly tailored compelling state interest in creating it. In McCrory, appellants contend the lower court decision against them erred in five critical ways. 1. Presuming racial predominance from North Carolina's legitimate reliance on Supreme Court precedent. 2. Applying a standard of review that required the state to demonstrate its construction of North Carolina Congressional District 1 was actually necessary under the VRA, instead of simply showing it had good reasons to believe the district, as created, was needed to foreclose future vote dilution claims. 3. Relieving plaintiffs of their burden to prove race rather than politics predominated with proof of a workable alternative plan. 4. Clearly erroneous fact-finding. And 5. Failing to dismiss plaintiffs' claims as being barred by claim preclusion or issue preclusion. Appellants further argue that, in the interest of judicial comity and federalism, the Supreme Court should order full briefing and oral argument to resolve the split between the court below and the North Carolina Supreme Court, which reached the opposite result in a case raising identical claims. In Bethune-Hill, appellants also assert five errors by the lower court. 1. Holding that race cannot predominate even where it is the most important consideration in drawing a given district, unless the use of race results in actual conflict with traditional districting criteria. 2. Concluding that the admitted use of a one-size-fits-all 55% black voting age population floor to draw 12 separate House of Delegates districts did not amount to racial predominance and trigger strict scrutiny. 3. Disregarding the admitted use of race in drawing district lines in favor of examining circumstantial evidence regarding the contours of the districts. 4. Holding that racial goals must negate all other districting criteria in order for race to predominate. And 5. Concluding that the General Assembly's predominant use of race in drawing House District 75 was narrowly tailored to serve a compelling government interest. To discuss the case, we have Jack Park, who is of counsel at Strickland Brockington Lewis LLP. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Park.
Last Monday, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in two cases. One, McCrory versus Harris, involved North Carolina's congressional districting. And the other, Bethune-Hill versus Virginia State Board of Elections, involved Virginia's House of Delegates. Just for the record, I'm counsel of record on an amicus brief in each case in support of the states, North Carolina and Virginia. The briefs were written for the Southeastern Legal Foundation, the Center for Equal Opportunity. In addition, I was involved in litigation over the last three rounds of legislative redistricting in Alabama, serving as lead trial counsel in the latest case, which became Alabama Legislative Black Caucus versus Alabama. In 1995, in Miller versus Johnson, the Supreme Court observed federal court review of districting litigation represents a serious intrusion on the most vital of state and local functions. It explained the distinction between being aware of racial considerations and being motivated by them may be difficult to make. This evidentiary burden, together with the sensitive nature of redistricting and the presumption of good faith that must be accorded legislative enactments, requires courts to exercise extraordinary caution in adjudicating claims that a state has drawn district lines on the basis of race. Redistricting is also an inherently political task. Given the overwhelming support that African American voters provide to Democrats at all levels of government, race and politics are interconnected. Both of these cases involve Republican legislators trying to balance race and politics, comply with the law, and also serve their own interests, and it's a very difficult balance to draw. For all of this, the Voting Rights Act and Supreme Court precedent require that race be considered in redistricting. In 1986, in Thornburg versus Gingles, the court set out a three-part test for identifying when a majority-minority district should be drawn. That test looks at whether the minority community is, first, sufficiently large and geographically compact to constitute a majority in a single-member district. Second, whether it's politically cohesive. And third, whether in the existing arrangement it's consistently outvoted by the white majority. Since Thornburg v. Gingles in 1986, the majority-minority districts, black-majority districts, that could be drawn have been drawn. In each new round of redistricting, though, the legislature needs to rebalance population so that the districts comply with constitutional one-person, one-vote standards and have approximately equal population. All parts of states don't grow the same way, and there's some rebalancing of population needed, and that requires redrawing of plans. For congressional plans, the tolerance for population deviation is very tight. It's close to a zero-sum game. For legislative and local districts, in contrast, more latitude is constitutionally permissible. That said, in the 2000 round of redistricting, Virginia and Alabama both tightened their legislative deviations from plus minus 5% or 10% to plus minus 1% or 2%. Formerly, in the covered jurisdictions, Section 5 would drive the preservation of majority-minority districts. If they were underpopulated, you would add population to them, typically more minority population than majority, in order to keep them black majority. Now, Gingles, with Section 5 gone as a result of Shelby County versus Holder, Gingles, in its interpretation of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, should drive the same result. We should have black majority districts in the same places that we typically have them, which is where they are large enough to be a majority in a district. But what majority do you preserve? We're about preserving a majority. In ALBC, the Supreme Court said that the relevant inquiry is to what extent do we have to preserve existing minority percentages in order to maintain the minority's present ability to elect a candidate of choice. That's a suggestion that having too many African American voters in a district may somehow be a problem. Just by way of introduction, Bethune-Hill and McCrory offered the Supreme Court a chance to heed its 20-year-old guidance about extraordinary caution. That's unlikely. So, in Bethune-Hill, the plan for the Virginia House of Delegates brought each of the majority-minority districts in at 55% BVAP, black voting age population. We should note that some Democrats think a majority should be 50% BVAP plus one. And in the Alabama case, our expert suggested that a district that was 50.1% African-American and 49.9% white would be a very difficult district to represent. On every issue, the population would seem to be pretty split, and that there's no way of curing that. But turning to the percentage alone, 50% BVAP plus one doesn't seem to be a very secure majority. And we're talking about the majority of African Americans. We don't care about the minority of other voters. Voting age population, though, includes people who are not entitled to register to vote. Non-citizens and felons are two examples. We also know that not everybody who is eligible to register to vote does so. Finally, we know that not everybody who is registered to vote actually does so. So 55% BVAP might look like a reasonable majority. We also know that in the Virginia House of Delegates, using a 55% BVAP goal brought down the African American population in 9 of the 12 majority-minority districts. They were all above 55%, those 9. It brought it up slightly in 2 others, which were at 52-53%, and brought one district from about 46% BVAP to a 55% majority. That was done with nearly universal support from the African American members of the Virginia House of Delegates who voted on the plan. Moreover, as Paul Clement, who represented Virginia, noted, the plan was used in 2 election cycles before this lawsuit was filed. All of that was not to the taste of the Bethune Hill Appellants, though. A 3-judge court upheld the plan, concluding that race did not predominate over other traditional districting criteria. In Miller versus Johnson, the court said, the plaintiff's burden is to show, either through circumstantial evidence of a district's shape or more direct evidence going to legislative purpose, that race was the predominant factor motivating the legislature's decision to place a significant number of voters within or without a particular district. To make this showing, a plaintiff must prove that the legislature subordinated traditional race-neutral districting principles, including but not limited to compactness, contiguity, and respect for political subdivisions or communities defined by actual shared interests, to racial considerations. Chief Justice Roberts asked about that. How do we identify predominance? In Miller versus Johnson and the Shaw case, the shape of the districts told us something, but the Virginia House of Delegates districts don't have odd shapes. If the criteria conflict, that might tell you something about predominance, but the Bethune Hill Appellants say they don't need an actual conflict. Responding to Justice Kagan, Mark Elias, their lawyer, said that the district court erred in thinking that if we find a district that looks like it's abided by traditional districting criteria, that's the end of the inquiry. Chief Justice Roberts jumped back in to point to what the SG had said. And the SG said, in the vast majority of cases, a conflict may be necessary to establish racial predominance. The SG argued in both cases, and in Bethune Hill, the SG said that bringing a district from 53% to 55% isn't enough standing alone. You would need more evidence than that to show that race predominated. The SG also had no problem bringing the districts that were above 55% down to 55%. The court discussed the need for actual conflict with the SG, who said that it had read the court's opinions to say that no actual conflict was needed, even though they argued that one was needed in Miller versus Johnson. Justice Breyer pointed to his ALBC opinion in a couple of places and its focus on the number of people moved into or out of a district and their race. In ALBC, the point of contention and the thing that Justice Breyer pointed to was ALBC Senate District 26. That case is now on remand. It's an odd-looking district, but the incumbent lives in one of the odd parts, and that odd part in which the incumbent lives is a complete precinct. In order to cure that part of the problem, you'd have to put the incumbent in another district or break up the precinct. In Bethune Hill, the real problematic district is the 46% district, which had to add African-American voters to get to 55%. In Bethune-Hill, Justices Kagan and Breyer seem to think that the district court used the wrong test. What that would produce is a remand without any assurance that the outcome would be different, but the dust would certainly be ground finer. In McCrory, two congressional districts were at issue. North Carolina's Congressional District 12 has been a bone of racial gerrymandering contention since Shaw versus Reno in 1993. And the question in McCrory is how to distinguish race from politics. In 2000, the court in Easley versus Cromartie said something that appears to be on point. In a case such as this one, where majority-minority districts, or the approximate equivalent, are at issue, and where racial identification correlates highly with political affiliation, the party attacking the legislatively drawn boundaries must show, at the least, that the legislature could have achieved its legitimate political objectives in alternative ways that are comparably consistent with traditional districting principles. That party must also show that these districting alternatives would have brought about significantly greater racial balance. For North Carolina Congressional District 1, the legislature took a plurality minority district, one that was about 48% African American, and brought it up above 50%. And they said they were complying with Bartlett versus Strickland. For the other, District 12, they said it was drawn for political reasons. North Carolina lost below, and it is odd that the district that's a remedy for past racial gerrymandering is now a racial gerrymander. It's the same district that was involved in Easley versus Cromartie. Justice Kagan, though, pushed back on the notion that Easley controlled, and Justice Breyer, who wrote the decision, joined in saying, when I said, in a case like this one, what does that mean? He also asked Mark Elias if the court should overrule Easley. Another question was, do you need a map, as Easley suggests? An alternative map that shows that you could do the same thing with greater racial balance. What if there's direct evidence of racial considerations? Elias said, we shouldn't need one then. Here, though, the legislature says it's politics, and there's a court cost when to courts calling them liars. For District 12, the plan drawer looked at political data everywhere but in Guilford County, and the consideration of race in Guilford County was informed by Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which was still effective. And as Paul Clement says, it's not the world's biggest burden to come up with an alternative map. If the map shows little change from what the legislature did, given the correlation between race and political affiliation, it seems that the fight is about a lot of nothing. Congressional District 1 presented a different problem. It was 97,563 people short of the ideal district. You needed to add population to it, and you wanted to keep it as a black majority district. It could have gone into Wake County or into Durham, and conversation with an incumbent drove it into Durham County. But the larger issue is a district that's underpopulated like that presents a serious problem for the legislature. One other question concerned the res judicata effect of prior state court litigation. The North Carolina courts had upheld not only the congressional plan, but also the legislative district against an attack. We presume that state courts are capable of handling federal constitutional and statutory claims. And as Justice Kennedy pointed out, the first-in-time decision would control. The Solicitor General told Chief Justice Roberts that the effect of the prior state court decision should be addressed using res judicata and issue and claim preclusion principles without being more definite. What do we think of going forward? There is a lot of redistricting litigation this latest round is a series of Democratic attacks on Republican plans with the goal of driving down the percentage of African Americans in black majority districts. But the question is, will a court tamp it down? Or, as Paul Clement put it, will it let Shaw claims be used to get around the tougher standards that apply to vote dilution claims? As Paul put it, these are junior varsity vote dilution claims, and the plaintiffs call them Shaw claims because it helps them. The second consideration is, what do you do with existing underpopulated crossover districts? A crossover district is one in which there is no black majority. Rather, it's in the mid to high 40s, and it wins with support from white voters who cross over and vote Democrat. It's inherently difficult to draw them in the first place, but the question is, all right, next round, do you preserve them in amber? In Bartlett versus Strickland, the court said, well, we don't want legislatures to have to draw crossover districts. In order to do that, they'd have to look at what percentage of white voters supported minority preferred candidates in the past. How reliable would the crossover votes be in future elections? What types of candidates have white and majority voters supported together? Were past crossover votes based on incumbency, and did that depend on race? What are the historical turnout rates among white and minority voters, and will they stay the same? Those vexing questions are the same kind of questions you get when you talk about preserving them. But in order to preserve them in amber, you have to use race in two ways. You have to add the right number of African Americans, and you also have to add the right number of white people, and you have to do both of them because of their race. Not only that, you have to get their politics right, because what you want to do, and the Democrats want this, you have to come back with a performing Democrat district. If our broader goal is to limit the use of race, wouldn't it be easier to bring a 46% underpopulated district to something over 50% when we rebalance the population? Finally, what about a map? Should we require one? My involvement in these cases suggests that it should be part of every case as a way of showing a plaintiff's bona fides, and the map should conform to what the legislature was trying to do. In the ALBC case on remand, the district court told the plaintiffs, all right, come up with a map to see what you could do. With that, I guess I'll conclude and say that it'd be nice if the court would get out of it, but I don't see them doing it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.